could get the chance of promotion to the next league. The one that loses may not even exist next season. Things can turn that quickly. We try to tell ourselves that hockey is only hockey, but of course it never is. One doctor mutters that money is ruining the sport. One nurse gives a long speech in the staff room about how the fat cats in the association keep coming up with impossible financial demands on smaller clubs, agents are sucking the market dry, the sponsors are just playing around, and games are decided in boardrooms rather than on the ice. Someone reads an article from a paper in which a sports commentator far from here predicts that teams such as Beartown and Hied will end up as feeder clubs for the bigger teams in a few years' time. Feeder clubs? As if we're going to be slaves to the big cities. Someone else snarls, if only Beartown had shut down, we could have concentrated all our efforts on one club. Which prompts the reply, why should we shut down? Why don't you shut down? The hospital staff start to argue and fall out, just like everyone else around here. But then something happens, the way it always does where they work. An alarm comes in. There's been an accident. Injured people are on their way. They forget about hockey games and club loyalties. Everyone in the emergency room works together, fights together, comes together as a team. They'll do their utmost to save the lives of everyone brought in by the ambulances tonight. It won't be enough. If Anna and Vidar had been an ordinary love story, perhaps they could have lived their whole lives together. Perhaps they would have gotten fed up with each other, broken up, or perhaps they would have kept on falling in love with the same person. An ordinary life is long if you live it together with someone else. But the thing about being an unusual teenager is that sometimes you just want to be an ordinary teenager. Anna is lying in bed. Vidar is lying quietly beside her. She's like Minecraft to him. He can concentrate when she's with him. Do you want to go to a party with me? She whispers. What? You heard. What sort of party? There's a party in one of the cabins at the campsite tonight. I heard about it at school. You don't have to come, but I just want to go to a party and feel normal, just for a while. Okay, Vidar says. Okay? Anna repeats. He grins. Are you deaf or something? Okay. She laughs. They kiss. It feels perfectly normal. Perfectly normal and perfectly wonderful. They go to the party. It feels normal, at least for a while. But then Vidar goes to the toilet, and the guy who comes up to Anna at the bar is from Hied, so he doesn't know who she is. Perhaps he doesn't even know who Vidar is. Anna tries to be pleasant. She turns down the drink the guy offers her and moves the hand he puts on her hip. The guy from Hied proudly shows her the tattoo of a bull on his arm, and says he might be playing on the A-team next season. Anna pushes him away when he starts whispering in her ear. She tries to move away. He grabs hold of her arm and laughs. Come on, don't be such a stiff. Live a little. He wraps his arms around her waist. He doesn't even see Vidar walking across the room. He doesn't see the black look in his eyes, the lowered brow as he pushes through the crowd. Vidar doesn't notice who he pushes aside or shoves into the tables around him. But Anna sees. She knows how simple it ought to be to get out of the situation. Let the guy from Hied know he's touched the wrong girl, picked an argument with the wrong guy. It would be so easy. But Anna has never done anything the easy way in her life. So she twists out of the guy's grasp, leans her upper body back, and headbutts him. She hears a crunch when her forehead hits his nose. He falls screaming to the floor. Anna feels blood drip down her face, doesn't know whose it is. The guy's friends are standing a few feet away, they're as shocked as everyone else, so Anna knows she has only a couple of seconds to act. She sees Vidar storm through the crowd with a murderous look in his eyes, and Anna does the only thing she can do, given that she is who she is and loves someone like him. She takes aim and punches Vidar right in the face. The room falls silent. Anna hits him again, harder. And Vidar stumbles backward. Then she grabs him by the arm and runs for the door. She drags him into the forest with her and runs until no one at the party will be able to find them. What's your problem? Vidar shouts when Anna finally stops among the trees. She feels almost guilty when she sees the way his face is swelling up. But she snaps, "You know what my problem is? Guys! Goddamn guys! You're my problem! What have I done now, then?" She's sobbing with rage now. "You would have killed him! If I hadn't got you out of there, you'd have beaten him to death and been sent to prison, and I..." She's gasping with angry, pent-up tears. Vidar stands in front of her with a split lip and an eye that's swelling up a bit more with each breath he takes. "I was just trying to help you." "What is it with guys? Why do you think we want you to fight over us the whole time? Why do you think you have to do everything violently? What the hell's wrong with you?"
"I don't know," he admits.
Anna starts laughing.
"I love you."
"Is that why you hit me?"
"Yes."
Vidar scratches his ear.
"Do you have to love me quite so hard?"
"I don't want to be on some crappy pedestal," she snaps.
"A what?"
"I don't want you to fight for my sake. I don't want you to do things for my sake. I just want you to believe in me. I don't want you to take me places. I want you to back me up so I can get there myself."
"Okay."
"What do you mean, okay?"
"Okay, I... just okay. Okay. I love you too."
"You're so stupid."
Her hand hurts so badly that she feels like curling up and howling. He leads her over to a snowdrift and makes her stick her hand in it. She screams. He tries to explain.
"You shouldn't hit someone like that. You need..."
He begins, but she snaps. "Don't you dare tell me how to punch you."
"Okay."
It's just possible that there are more normal love stories. The next day, Vidar comes to Anna's martial arts training. He doesn't say anything, just drags 6 wooden pallets in from the yard and piles them on top of each other to form rough steps. Then he goes and stands on them.
"What's that?" Anna wonders irritably.
"A pedestal," Vidar tells her.
"Who for?"
she asks.
"Me,"
he replies. She starts to laugh, but he's serious.
"I'll stand tall if you stand tall," he says.
She stops laughing then and kisses him. Normal love stories have never held any appeal for her anyway. How it started? We're never going to stop arguing about that. Perhaps it started with that guy from Hied who was trying it on at a party with a girl from Beartown and ended up with a broken nose. Perhaps he bore a grudge. Or perhaps it began much earlier, at that first hockey game of the autumn, where the Hied supporters chanted terrible things about Benjamin Ovich. Perhaps some people in Beartown were unable to let go of that, especially after Hied won the game. Or perhaps it started one morning in early winter, when someone left a bloody bull's horn outside the doors of the arena in Hied. It wasn't even real blood, probably just a stupid joke by some drunk teenagers, but not everyone in Hied saw it that way. One evening, not long after that, a guy from Beartown was standing in line at a pizzeria in Hied. His girlfriend was from Hied and was waiting for him at home. Some guys from Hied were standing farther back in the line and started chanting those same words. One of them leaned forward and shouted them straight in his ear. Another yelled that he should fuck off home and leave women from Hied the hell alone. The guy from Beartown turned around and told them to go to hell, and the guys from Hied knocked the pizzas out of his hands. The staff managed to get between them before there was any serious trouble, but perhaps that was how it started. Unless it started with all the rumors about the hospital and the factory, when everything became a fight over jobs. Once upon a time, people used to worry that the politicians would try to merge Hied and Beartown to form a single larger town, but now they worry that there might not even be enough room for 2 small ones. Soon after the incident with the bull's horn outside the arena and the tussle in the pizzeria, Hied Hockey and Beartown Hockey's 9-year-olds met at a tournament some distance away. The game was evenly matched, the boys were wound up, and when one of the 9-year-olds from Hied started to chant, "Queers! Sluts! Rapists!" a fight broke out among so many of the kids that their parents had to jump onto the ice to help the referee break them up. One father from Hied and another from Beartown tried to separate their sons,
and one of the fathers thought the other grabbed his son a bit too hard. The dads started shouting, then jostling each other, and soon it was the kids who were trying to stop the adults fighting rather than the other way around. Around the same time, two older men started to squabble in the waiting room at Hiad Hospital, because one thought he was having to wait longer than the other. The second man muttered, "Bloody Beartown bastards, build your own hospital and stop coming here to use up our health service." Perhaps none of this would have mattered if it hadn't all happened during the same autumn and winter. Perhaps it wouldn't have escalated if there hadn't been a natural opportunity for all those people to meet in the same ice rink again before the year was out. But of course there was. Another hockey game between Hied and Beartown. One morning not long before the game, two men drive from Hied to the factory in Beartown to apply for jobs. They've been unemployed for a long time. They both have children, and when the factory's new owners offered them interviews, it was like a gift from the gods. They park the car outside the factory. When they get back to it after their interviews, they find it's been smashed to pieces. The doors have been kicked in, and a large tree branch has been shoved through the windshield. There aren't any witnesses, of course, even though some men in black jackets are standing nearby. Among the broken glass on the driver's seat is a note reading, "Beartown jobs for Beartown people." Perhaps that was how it started. Unless it started when a small group of men from Hied meet up soon after that to discuss how to get revenge. They want to hurt the pack. They want to take something the men in the black jackets love away from them. "I want to set fire to their goddamn homes," one of the men from Hied mutters at that meeting. Perhaps he doesn't mean it literally, but one of his friends replies, "Then that's what we'll do." Chapter 47. A Love Story We Will Never Forget. It's hard to keep a secret in the locker room. Any sort of secret. In the arena in Hied, practices are getting more and more tense. Everyone in there has stopped referring to Beartown inhabitants as people, increasingly preferring to use terms such as the Greens, or the baby bears are going to get slaughtered, or the bitches, or the bastard fags. William Leet might have been expected to be one of the loudest voices, but for some reason he's becoming quieter and quieter. When his teammates ask why he's being so quiet, he says he's just trying to focus on hockey. He has no better answer. Something odd has been happening to him this autumn and winter. The more everyone has started to hate each other, the more fed up he is with himself. He has been angry for so long, angry at hockey, angry at school, angry at home, that in the end, perhaps he simply doesn't have the energy to carry on being so angry. "Focus on your hockey," his mom said, patting his head tenderly. So that's what he's done. He's distancing himself more and more from the rest of the team, training harder on his own. He meets a girl from Hied and starts spending his evenings with her. One day, David calls him into his office. He gives him a note with a phone number written on it, belonging to a scout for one of the elite clubs several divisions above Hied. "They're interested in you. They want you to call them." As William stares at the note, David walks around the desk and puts his hands on his shoulders. "I've seen you focusing more on your hockey recently, William, and noticed that you've let go of all that other nonsense outside, the fighting and so on. That's good. That's why this club is interested. You can be something, William. You can go a long way. But you know I'm going to fight to keep you playing for me. I think you'll be ready to be captain next season." Then David says something terrible. Something that completely destroys a young man who's scared of showing his feelings. "I'm proud of you, William." William walks straight out of the office and calls his mother. It's hard to keep a secret in the locker room, so everyone congratulates William when he comes back. He's proud, obviously, but he also notices that they stop talking when he's around. He realizes that they're talking about something they don't want him to hear. After practice, there are two cars parked outside the ice rink,
containing young men with bull tattoos and hooded tops. A couple of William's teammates, the ones who are young enough to want to fight and not good enough at hockey to have anything to lose, walk straight to the cars.
"Where are you going?" William asks.
One of them turns around. "The less you know, the better, William. You're too important for the team to be involved in this. We need you on the ice."
"What the hell are you planning?" William asks, confused.
The men with the bull tattoos don't reply, but one of the guys from the team is too excited to stop himself, so he shouts, "We're gonna see how well bearskin burns!" The cars drive off, leaving William standing there alone. When the police question them afterward, the men from Hied will have 1,000 excuses. Someone will say they didn't mean to set fire to the whole building. They just thought the door would burn and they'd have time to put it out before it was too late. One will say they just wanted to make a point, and another will say it was only supposed to be a joke. None of them knew there was an apartment above the Bearskin pub, or that Ramona was asleep up there. Ma Gan Liet picks her son up from Hied Ice Rink, just as she does after every practice. She has sandwiches and protein smoothies with her. She puts his bag in the trunk, plays his favorite music all the way home. But he doesn't say a word.
"What is it?" his mom asks.
"Nothing, it's nothing. I'm just nervous about the game," William mumbles. He pretends it's true, and Ma Gan pretends to believe him. They don't want to hurt each other's feelings. They have dinner and listen as William's father talks about his day at work, laugh when William's sister talks about her day. She unscrewed the lids of the salt cellars on the teacher's lunch table, so they fell off when the teachers tried to season their lunch. William taught her that. Ma Gan tries to scold her, but the girl's laughter is so infectious that she doesn't have the heart. Today, more than usual, William watches his parents as they eat and chat. He's well aware of what people in this town say about his family, that his dad is so cheap he cries when he takes a shit, and that his mother is a crazy hockey mom. That might be true, but there are other things that can be said about them, too. They've never had anything handed to them on a plate. They've had to fight for everything. And they want to give their children all the things they themselves never had. Power over their own lives without having to struggle every day. Maybe they go too far sometimes, but William is only too willing to forgive them. This world isn't built for kind people. Kind people get exploited and crushed. William just has to look around Beartown to see that. After dinner, he watches a cartoon in his sister's room. When she was born, the doctors said there was something wrong with her. There wasn't. She's just special. People keep wanting to describe her using the name of her condition, but William refuses. She is who she is, the kindest person he knows. When she falls asleep, he goes down to the basement to do some weight training on his own. But those words are gnawing away at him. "We're going to see how well bearskin burns." He can't let go of them. So he puts on his tracksuit and tells his mom he's going out for a run. Ma Gan Liet hopes it's because her son is nervous. After the door closes behind him, she goes straight to the kitchen. She always worries about her children. Whenever William isn't home, she channels her anxieties into making food. "Say what you like about Ma Gan Liet, but she's a good cook," people say. The fact that they feel the need to preface the sentence with "say what you like" doesn't bother her. She knows who she is. She fights for everything she's got. She ends up making a pasta salad, then some potato salad. "No one can make so many salads out of things that aren't supposed to be salads as you, Mom. You can make any vegetable unhealthy," William usually says with a grin. She stays awake until he gets home, worrying the whole time. William runs through Beartown. Suddenly he realizes that he's wearing his red tracksuit with the bull on the chest. Even he appreciates what a stupid provocation that is around here right now. He turns to run home and get changed, but stops when he notices the smell. It catches in his nostrils. Something's burning. The smoke doesn't wake Ramona. She wakes up to find someone tugging at her. Ramona may have drunk one or two late-night snacks, so she reacts the way she always does when someone wakes her. She flails her arms, yells obscenities, and tries to find a solid object to use as a weapon. But when she sees the flames licking the walls and hears the shouting from the street, she opens her eyes and finds herself staring into Elizabeth Zakhel's. The hockey coach may be bad with feelings, but she's still capable of getting nervous. She couldn't sleep tonight, was thinking too much about the upcoming game against Hied, so she went out jogging. She saw some men running away from the bearskin, saw the fire take hold. Most people would probably have called the fire department and waited out in the street. No one normal would have run into the burning building. But, of course, Zakhel isn't normal. When she sinks down onto the street outside, coughing and gasping for breath, Ramona stands beside her in her nightdress, muttering, "You do that for a few plates of potatoes, girl? What the hell would you have been prepared to do if I'd given you some meat?" Zakhel coughs and laughs. "I have to admit I'm starting to get a taste for beer. Vitamins are important." People come running from all directions, no one faster than Tima. He throws himself into the snow and wraps his arms around Ramona. "There now, lad, calm yourself down. Everyone's still alive. It's just a few flames," Ramona whispers, but he can feel her shaking. "All your pictures of Holger," Tima exclaims, getting to his feet. Ramona has to hold him back. That's how much she loves the boy. That she's prepared to hold him back, to stop him rushing into the fire to rescue the photographs of her dead husband. But she can't hold Tima hard enough to stop him from doing what happens next. No one can. The whole of Beartown is awakened by the fire. Cries spread through the town faster than drums, faster than sirens. Everyone's phone rings, everyone's door opens. Benji and his sisters come racing down the street. His sisters run toward the bearskin. People have started to form a chain to pass buckets. Cars are bringing tanks of water and hoses. But Benji stands still, because he realizes that this isn't a coincidence. It never is. So Benji tries to find a perpetrator, and all he can see is the red tracksuit. William Leet is standing a short distance behind everyone else, closer to the forest, alone and shocked with his hand over his mouth. Benji rushes straight at him. For a moment, William thinks he's going to attack him, but Benji stops abruptly as if he's realized something. People are running back and forth across the road. There are sirens in the distance now, on their way through the forest. Benji turns to William and snarls, "You and me. Now. For real. No friends, no weapons. Just you and me." William could have protested, could have tried to calm Benji down and explain that he had nothing to do with the fire. But Benji is too wound up now to believe that, and perhaps William still hates him too much to back down. So he merely whispers, "Where?" Benji thinks for a moment. "The running track on the heights. No people, even ground. Lights." William nods stiffly. "So I won't have any excuses afterward, you mean?" Benji's actions have always been worse than his words. For that reason, his reply is particularly loaded. "There won't be an afterward for you, William." They run to the jogging track, through the whole town. They've done it 1,000 times before. When they played hockey on the same team, they used to compete in every training session. Benji could never let William be best at anything. He used to take things from William that he didn't even want. Now, as they run with snow up to their ankles, they're those same boys again. They even run a few feet apart, as if Kevin were still running between them. When they reach the running track on the heights, they stop and catch their breath for a few seconds. Thick clouds billow from their mouths. Then, still wearing his red tracksuit, William rushes straight at Benji, who's standing there waiting in his green shirt with his fists clenched. No friends, no weapons, just the two of them. A bull against a bear. Spider and Woody find Tima outside the bearskin. Their first instinct is to help put the fire out to protect people. This pub is their home, more than their homes have ever been. But Spider whispers in Tima's ear, "We know who they are, those bastards from Hied. Woody's girlfriend saw them through her kitchen window.
They left their cars down by the supermarket. If we set off now, we can catch up with them.
When the men in black jackets pull away from the crowd outside the bearskin and run toward Tima's Saab to hunt the enemy through the forest, hardly anyone notices them. The only person watching is a teenage boy, Leo Anderson. He follows them. William and Benji don't pull their punches. Their blows are frenzied. They're both so strong that their faces are bloody after just a few seconds. William lets out a yell every time he swings and lands a punch, from a mixture of exhaustion and fury. He's taller than Benji, the only advantage Benji has never been able to take from him, and can punch downward while Benji has to punch up. It's harder to punch upward. They swing wildly at each other for what seems an age, until lactic acid forces them both to back away, gasping for air, streaming with blood. Benji has lost a tooth, and William can hardly see with his right eye. "Were you in love with him?" he suddenly snarls. "What?" Benji shouts, spitting blood onto the snow. They're standing a few feet apart, their lungs heaving. William puts his hands on his knees. One of his fingers is broken, and his nose is bleeding like a tap. He lowers his voice as pain and exhaustion hit him. "Were you in love with Kevin?" he pants. Benji says nothing for several minutes. He's got blood in his hair and on his hands. It's impossible to tell where he's bleeding from and where he's just wiped it off. "Yes." It's the first time in his life that Benji has admitted that. William closes his eyes and feels his nose throb as he tries to breathe through it. "If I'd known that, I wouldn't have hated you so much," he whispers.
"I know," Benji says.
William straightens up, stands with his hands by his sides, his tracksuit top torn and stained with sweat. "Do you remember that summer when we were little, when it rained nonstop for a whole month, when the ice rink flooded?" Benji looks surprised, but nods slowly.
"Yes."
William wipes his nose with the back of his hand. "You and Kevin were always out in the forest in the summer, but when it rained, you both used to come to my place and ask if we could play hockey in the basement. I don't know why you didn't go back to Kevin's, but Kev's parents were having their house renovated that summer," Benji reminds him. William nods in acknowledgement.
"Oh yeah, that was why.
We played hockey in my basement every day that month. And we were friends then. You were okay. We didn't mess with each other." Benji spits more blood on the snow.
"We slept on mattresses on the floor so we could start playing the moment we woke up."
William's smile is heavy with missed opportunities and lost years. "When other people our age talk about their childhoods, they always seem to remember the sun shining the whole time. All I remember is constantly hoping for rain." Benji stands still. In the end, he sits down in the snow. William doesn't know if he's crying, doesn't know if it shows that he is. Then the two men go their separate ways, not as friends and not as enemies. They just go their separate ways. It's late by the time Maya and Anna finally stop training at their martial arts club. Far too late, in Maya's mother's opinion, but she still picks her daughter up without protest. She offers Anna a lift, but Anna shakes her head secretively and Maya teases her. "She's going over to see Vidar." It makes Maya so happy, because that's the kind of thing ordinary 16-year-old best friends do. Tease each other about boys. Maya gets into the Volvo, waves to Anna through the rear window. Vidar is waiting at the edge of the forest. He and Anna walk hand in hand through the night. He's humming and whistling. He can't stop drumming his fingers against his leg. And if they had lived a whole life together, perhaps Anna would have started to get irritated by his lack of impulse control. But right now, she loves it, the fact that all his emotions live inside him in the same way, instantly. If they had lived their whole lives together, perhaps they would have gone walking in other places, perhaps in sunshine in some other country. Perhaps they would have moved away from here and started again somewhere else, grown up and built a home together. Perhaps had children, aged and grown old together. Anna stands on tiptoe to kiss him. His phone rings.
she notices the smell of smoke. When she sees the sudden look of horror on Vidar's face and he starts to run, she doesn't try to stop him. She runs alongside him. A white car is driving along the road, far too fast. The men from Hied inside it are little more than boys. Can we forgive them for that? How old do we have to be held accountable for our actions, even when the consequences end up being so infinitely worse than we imagine? When the Saab appears in the rearview mirror and the men in the white car realize that they're being pursued, they panic. They speed up, the Saab behind them does the same, the driver of the white car takes his eyes off the road, and a moment later, the headlights of a third car shine through the windshield and dazzle him. It's a large Volvo heading the other way. The white car skids on the snow. The men from Hied inside it scream. The tires lose their grip on the road. Thousands of pounds of metal take flight just for a moment, hanging silently in the darkness. Then comes a collision so terrible that we will never really stop hearing it. Kira and Maya are sitting in the Volvo. They've just left the kennels when Kira's phone rings. It's Peter. He's already run into town. "The bearskin's on fire! I don't know where Leo is!" he roars. The kennel is located a fair way into the forest. There are only two routes back to Beartown, the ordinary winding road that all normal people use, but also a barely maintained track through the trees with no lighting that's occasionally used by hunters. The track leads directly to the main road that runs between Beartown and Hied. Never have a mother and a sister driven that track faster than they do tonight. A few minutes later, the Volvo slides out of the forest with its engine roaring down onto the main road. Some way down the road, an old man is driving toward them from Hied and blows his horn angrily. Kira couldn't care less. She puts her foot down. Then she sees the white car. It's coming toward them far too fast. Maya lets out a scream before Kira has time to react. The driver of the white car loses control, and the car skids across the road. Kira slams on the brakes, steers the Volvo toward the ditch, and throws herself across the seat to protect her daughter. The white car loses its grip on the road, takes off, and smashes into a tree. Leo Anderson is running through the forest, darting between the trees to get there before the cars. He isn't fast enough. Thank God. He isn't fast enough. There's an old man who's a regular at the Bearskin. He usually sits with four other old men arguing about hockey. His eyesight isn't good. The other old men sometimes swap his spectacles for cheap reading glasses to make him think he's gone blind when he puts them on. As Ramona usually snaps, "So if he does go blind, how the hell is he going to know about it?" The old man is wearing his own glasses tonight, but still can't see well in the dark. He tried saying that to the staff at the hospital. His wife isn't home tonight, and his children have long since moved to bigger cities in search of better jobs and sushi bars and whatever the hell else young people want from big cities, and the old man woke up with a pain in his chest. So he got into his car and drove from Beartown to Hied, and sat for several hours in the hospital before finally being told that it was nothing to worry about. Probably just indigestion. "Have you ever considered drinking less alcohol?" the doctor wondered. "Have you ever considered a lobotomy?" the old man wondered, and told the doctor off for making him wait so long. "He doesn't see well in the dark. He promised his wife he wouldn't drive tonight." "We're understaffed," the doctor says. The old man drove away, feeling aggrieved. What sort of crappy hospital is this, anyway? Then, when he's driving back from Hied to Beartown, some crazy woman in a Volvo suddenly appears out of the forest and pulls out right in front of him. She'd evidently decided to take a shortcut to town, and the old man brakes and blows his horn and flashes his headlights, but of course the stupid woman doesn't care. That's just how people drive these days. The Volvo is driving so fast that soon the old man can only just see its rear lights. Snow is blowing hard against the windshield. It's dark. The old man curses and squints through his glasses. He doesn't even see exactly what happens next. He has no chance to react.
The stupid woman in the Volvo suddenly brakes and lurches toward the side of the road. Two cars are approaching from the other direction. Perhaps the old man has time to see that the first one is white. It leaves the ground, rolls over, and smashes into a tree with horrific force. The car behind it is a Saab, the old man might have time to notice. It was evidently pursuing the white car, because it brakes sharply and slides across the entire width of the road, and Tima, Spider, and Woody throw the doors open and leap out. The old man probably recognizes them from the bearskin. The old man brakes, but it's snowing. It's dark. Even if the brakes do all they can, perhaps no one could have stopped at that distance, not in this weather. Perhaps it isn't anyone's fault. The old man isn't wearing a seatbelt. He's driving an old car, has old eyes. He passes the Volvo and then wrenches the wheel as hard as he can as he swerves past the Saab. He doesn't have time to see what he hits. Never hears the thud on the hood of his car. He's already hit his head on the steering wheel and lost consciousness. Kira throws herself out of the Volvo, runs around the car, and pulls Maya from the passenger seat. That's the mother's first thought, to get her daughter away from the road, protect her. They're hugging each other tightly in the ditch when a third person embraces them, hard, as if he thinks they'll leave him forever if he lets go. It's Leo. Anna and Vidar are running through the forest, faster than either of them really has the energy for. If they had lived a whole life together, perhaps they might have enjoyed competing against each other. If they had had children, they would probably never have stopped arguing about which of them was fastest. They hear the crashes from down on the road and change direction instinctively, running toward the noise. Vidar hears Tima's voice, then Spider's and Woody's yelling, "Call an ambulance!" and "Watch out!" Vidar and Anna's fingertips nudge each other one last time. Theirs is no ordinary love story. They may have loved each other for a shorter time than many of us, but they've loved harder than most. "It's on fire!" Anna cries as they reach the road. On the far side, they can see that a car has smashed into a tree, its front end crumpled around the trunk. The people inside are unconscious. Smoke is seeping out of the gaps in the hood. Anna shouts again, "It's on fire! It's on fire!" Then she runs. Vidar tries to stop her, but she's already out of his reach. Because she's been raised by a dad who told her, "We're not the type who let other people down, you and me." So she runs toward the burning white car, straight across the road. The old man driving back from hospital in Hied doesn't see what he's heading toward until it's too late. He passes the Volvo and swerves around the Saab, braking as hard as he can. Anna is in the middle of the road. Vidar runs, shouts, but everything happens too quickly. So Vidar throws himself forward and shoves Anna out of the way. Because he's the sort of person who lacks any impulse control. He can't help himself saving the life of the person he loves. Anna rolls into the ditch, gets to her feet in the snow, and lets out a howl, but the person she loves isn't there to hear it. The old man's car is skidding too fast. It hits with full force, and the body slams onto the hood. Vidar Renius dies the same way he lived. Instantly. Theirs was a love we will always remember. Chapter 48.
Oh God, oh God, oh God, my baby. Have you ever seen a town fall?
Ours did.
Have you ever seen a town rise?
Ours did that too.
Have you seen people who usually can't agree on a damn thing, be it politics, religion, sports, or anything else, come rushing from all directions to help one another put out a fire in an old pub? Have you seen them save one another's lives?
We did.
Perhaps you would have done the same thing.
Perhaps you're not as unlike us as you think. We did our very, very best. We gave all we had that night. But we still lost.
There are many beautiful trees in Beartown.
We sometimes say that's because a new one grows every time we bury someone. That's why the births are listed alongside the deaths in the local paper, so we never run out of either trees or people. It doesn't matter. We don't want a new tree, another person. We just want this one back.
Oh, God! Oh, God! Oh, God!
Vidar's mother screams when she collapses into the arms of the men standing in her kitchen, drowned in tears. The men have no words. They're tumbling into the same darkness as she is. Vidar's mother lies on the floor, wailing inconsolably.
My baby! Where's my baby? Where's my baby? Where's my baby? Where's my baby?
Bloody kids. How often does a mother think that while her children are growing up? Bloody kids. How much does she have to shout at them? How many times does she have to tell a young boy to do even the simplest little thing, like tying his shoelaces?
Tie your laces, she says.
Does the boy listen? Of course not.
Tie your laces before you trip, she says. You'll end up falling and hurting yourself.
You'll hurt yourself, bloody kid. Leo didn't tie his laces properly that night. If he had, he would have been a few seconds quicker through the trees, out of the forest, onto the road. He would have been there when the car arrived. Just a few seconds. Just one shoelace and a badly tied knot. So Kira falls asleep on Leo's bed that night, and he doesn't make her go away. And what an incredible gift that is to a mother from a teenager. They both wake up when Maya creeps in and curls up beside them. Kira holds her children so hard that they can't breathe. Bloody kids. Bloody, bloody, bloody kids. When Vidar was little, he didn't seem to be afraid of anything. All the other children had nightmares and wanted the light left on, but not him. When he and Tima shared a room and had a bunk bed, Vidar insisted on sleeping on the bottom. It took Tima several months to realize why. He woke up one night and heard Vidar crying, so he jumped down and forced him to explain why. Eventually, the little boy, no more than 5 or 6 years old, said he was convinced that there were horrible monsters that came into the house at night.
So why the hell do you want to sleep in the bottom bunk, then? Tima asked.
Vidar sniffed.
So the monsters will get me first, and you have time to escape.
He couldn't help himself. Ever. The path back to normal life is indescribably long once death has swept the feet out from under those of us who are left. Grief is a wild animal that drags us so far out into the darkness that we can't imagine ever getting home again. Ever laughing again. It hurts in such a way that you can never really figure out if it actually passes or if you just get used to it. Anna sits on the floor outside Vidar's hospital room all night. Tima and his mother sit on either side of her. They hold Anna's hands, unless she's holding theirs. Three people loved Vidar Renius so much that they wouldn't have hesitated to change places with him if they could. That's not a bad achievement for anyone. One day they might be able to think that thought without falling apart. A boy has died tonight. An old man, too. A mother and a brother and a girlfriend sit in a hospital. An old woman goes home to a house that will never stop feeling empty. Two men from Hied will go to prison for arson. One of them will probably never walk again after the car crash in the forest. And some of us will never believe that's anywhere near enough of a punishment. Some of us will say it was an accident. Some that it was murder. Some will think it was only those men's fault. Others will say that more were responsible, that it was many people's fault. Ours. It's so easy to get people to hate one another. That's what makes love so impossible to understand. Hate is so simple that it always ought to win. It's an uneven fight. Spider and Woody and the men in black jackets sit in the waiting room at the hospital for almost 24 hours. They're surrounded by men and women, old and young, in white shirts, green t-shirts. They stay long after the doctors emerge with somber faces to shake everyone's hand and convey their condolences.
as if Vidar won't be properly dead until they leave the hospital. No one in either town will know what to say. Sometimes it's easier to do something instead. When the cars leave the hospital in Hied, Tima and his mother drive at the back of the convoy, so at first they don't understand why everyone is slowing down. Not until they look at the trees. Someone has knocked the snow from the bare branches and hung thin strips of fabric all the way back. It's no big deal, just strips of fabric fluttering in a forest in the wind. But every second one is red, and every second one is green, so that the families in the cars will know that Beartown isn't grieving alone. When Tima and his mother get home, there's someone sitting on the steps waiting for them. Is that Kira Anderson? Tima's mother wonders. Tima gets out of the car without saying anything. Kira doesn't speak either. She just stands up and goes inside with them, goes straight to the kitchen, and starts to clean and make food. Tima takes his mother to the bedroom and sits with her until the pills grant her the respite of sleep. He goes back out to the kitchen. Kira hands him the brush without a word. He washes. She dries. Chapter 49. Everyone gets a stick. Two goals, two teams. Life is a weird thing. We spend all our time trying to manage different aspects of it, yet we are still largely shaped by things that happen beyond our control. We will never forget this year, not the best of it, and not the worst. It will never stop influencing us. Some of us will move to different places, but most of us will stay. This isn't an uncomplicated place, but when you grow up, you realize that nowhere is. God knows Beartown and Hied have plenty of faults, but they belong to us. This is our corner of the world. Anna and Maya are training in the barn up at the kennels, hour after hour. Things aren't good. Things will never be all right for either of them again, but they will still find a way of getting up each morning. When Anna falls apart and just screams and cries, Maya holds her best friend tight and whispers in her ear, "Survivors, Anna. Survivors. We are survivors." Early one morning, as soon as the sun has struggled above the horizon, there's a knock on the door of a mechanic's workshop. It's the middle of winter, toward the end of a childhood, and when Bobo opens the door, he finds Benji, Ahmet, and Zachariah standing outside. They go down to the lake with sticks and a puck and play together, one last time, as if it were all just a game and nothing else mattered. In 10 years' time, Ahmet will be a professional player, playing in huge arenas. Zacharias will be a pro as well, but in front of a computer. Bobo will be a father. By the time they finish playing down on the lake, it's almost dark again. Benji gives the others a brief wave and shouts goodbye, as if they're going to see each other tomorrow. Hied Hockey plays Beartown Ice Hockey for the second time this season, in a game that means absolutely everything and nothing at all. In the kitchen of a house up on the heights, Magan Leet is making pasta salad and potato salad. She places them in big bowls and covers them with plastic wrap. She doesn't know if she's a good or a bad person. She knows that most people assume that they're good, but she never has. She has always seen herself first and foremost as a fighter. For her family, for her children, and for her town. Even when this town wants nothing to do with her. Sometimes good people do bad things out of good intentions, and sometimes the reverse happens. She takes her salads and drives through the town, past the ice rink, and out along the road. She stops outside the home of the Renius family and knocks on the door. Say what you like about Magan Leet, but she's someone's mother as well. It's nearing the time for the puck to drop in the rink. All the players should be in their own locker rooms, but despite this, William Leet is heading the other way along the corridor. He stops in the doorway and waits until Ahmet and Bobo catch sight of him. "Have you got any more of those?" he asks quietly. Ahmet and Bobo look confused, but one of the older players understands what William means. He fetches a black armband, the sort all the Beartown players are already wearing, and hands it over. William pulls it on over his sleeve and nods his thanks. I'm truly sorry for your loss. Our whole team is. The Beartown players nod curtly in response. Tomorrow they'll hate each other again. Tomorrow. Benji stands outside the ice rink for a long time. He's smoking in the shade of some trees, his feet deep in the snow. He's played ice hockey his whole life, for so many different reasons, for so many different people's sake. Some things demand our all, and choosing this sport is like choosing a classical instrument. It's too difficult just to be a hobby. No one wakes up one morning and just happens to be a world-class violinist or pianist, and the same applies to hockey players. It takes a lifetime of obsession. It's the sort of thing that can absorb your entire identity. In the end, an 18-year-old man is left standing outside an ice rink thinking, "Who can I be if I'm not this?" Benji doesn't play this game. He's already far away when it starts. The coach of Hied Hockey seeks out the coach of Beartown Hockey in a corridor. Elizabeth Zakel looks surprised, and David gestures toward a shy 17-year-old behind him who's carrying his bag over his shoulder. David has an entire speech prepared in his head, one that's supposed to sound grown up and understanding and just right in light of all the terrible things that have happened. But his lips refuse to let it out. He wants to be sensitive, or at least to sound sensitive, but sometimes it's easier to do things than to say them. So he nods toward the young man. "This is our backup goalie. I think he can become a damn fine player with the right coach, and, well, he doesn't get much time on the ice with us, so if you..." "What?" Zakel wonders, not taking her eyes off the 17-year-old, who's refusing to look up from the floor. David clears his throat. "I've called the association. Considering the circumstances, they're prepared to allow a transfer." Zakel raises her eyebrows. "You're giving me a goalie?" David nods. "Everyone says you're good with goalies. I think you can turn him into a fantastic player." "What's your name?" Zakel asks, but the goalie merely mutters something in the direction of the floor. David coughs awkwardly. The guys in the team call him Mumble, because that's all he ever does. He's right. The boy will become a damn fine goalie, and he'll never utter an unnecessary word. Elizabeth Zakel takes an immediate liking to him. He comes from Hied, but he will play for Beartown for almost 20 years, never for any other club. And one day he will be more of a bear than anyone else in the eyes of the fans. But he will never wear number one, because that's Vidar's number. He will write the number one on his helmet instead, and the Black Jackets will always cheer extra loud for him because of that. David shakes his hand, and the 17-year-old goes into the locker room. David shuffles his feet awkwardly, then plucks up the courage to ask Zakel, "How's Benji?" Zakel's lower lip quivers almost imperceptibly. Her voice trembles ever so slightly. "Okay. I think he's going to be... okay." She too will save a jersey with the number 16 on it, on all her teams, for as long as she's a coach. She and David look each other in the eye, and Zakel says, "Give us hell out there on the ice this evening." David smiles. "You give us hell." It's one hell of a game. People will talk about it for years. Tima comes to the kennels on his own. He's carrying an envelope, and he climbs up to join Benji on the roof. Tima hesitates, then sits down next to him. "Are you going to the game?" Tima wonders. Benji's reply isn't contrary. It actually sounds almost happy. "No. Are you?" Tima nods. He'll never stop going to watch hockey. Some people might think the sport would remind him too much of his little brother now. But in actual fact, for long periods of Tima's life, it will be one of the few places where he can bear to remember Vidar. Where it doesn't hurt. "You're going away, aren't you?" he asks eventually. Benji looks surprised. "How do you know?" Tima's eyes flash for a moment. "You look the way I hoped Vidar would one day. Like you're thinking of getting out, Tima looks as though the slightest puff of wind could blow him to pieces. Benji passes him a cigarette.
Where would you have liked Vidar to go?
Tima blows smoke through his nose. Anywhere he could have become something more. What are you planning to do?
Benji takes a deep drag on the cigarette.
I don't know. I just want to find out who I am if I'm not a hockey player. I don't think I can do that if I stay here.
Tima nods seriously.
You're one hell of a hockey player.
Thanks, Benji says.
Tima gets up quickly, as if he's worried the conversation might go in a direction he's not ready for. He drops the envelope into Benji's lap.
Spider and Woody read something online about there being a rainbow fund that collects money for, you know, people who've been assaulted and imprisoned and shit in other countries because they're...
He falls silent.
Benji looks at the envelope and whispers,
Like me?
Tima looks away, stubs out the cigarette and coughs.
Well, the guys decided they wanted the money we had in the kitty at the Bearskin to go to... that. So they wanted to give it to you.
Benji swallows, feeling crushed.
So you want me to give the money to that rainbow fund because I'm one of them?
Tima has already started to climb down the ladder, but he stops and looks Benji in the eye.
No, we want you to give them the money because you're one of us.
Ramona is stomping around inside the Bearskin, drinking her lunch and directing the workmen with plenty of ripe swearing. Peter Anderson walks in, looking just like the boy he once was whenever he came to collect his drunken dad.
How's it going? He asks, looking around at the renovations.
Ramona shrugs.
It smells better after the fire than it did before.
Peter smiles weakly. So does she. They're not ready to laugh yet, but at least they've started to move in the right direction. Peter takes such a deep breath that his pupils quiver before he says,
This is for you, in your capacity as a board member of Beartown Ice Hockey.
Ramona looks at the sheet of paper he puts down on the bar without saying anything. She has a pretty good idea what it is, so she refuses to touch it.
There's a whole heap of dreary old men in smart jackets on that board. Give it to one of them.
Peter shakes his head. I'm giving it to you, because you're the only person on the board I trust.
She pats his cheek. The door to the Bearskin opens. Peter turns around and sees Tima in the doorway. The two men instinctively raise their hands toward each other, as if to indicate that neither of them wants any trouble.
I can come back later, Tima offers.
No, I was just leaving anyway, Peter insists.
Ramona snorts at the pair of them. Shut up, both of you. Sit down and have a beer. On the house.
Peter clears his throat.
I'd take a coffee.
Tima hangs his jacket up.
Me too.
Peter raises his cup in a vain attempt at a toast.
Tima does the same.
Honestly, men,
Ramona mutters irritably.
Peter looks down at the bar when he says,
I don't know if this makes it better or worse, but I think Vidar could have gone a long way as a hockey player. Maybe all the way.
He was very good indeed.
He was an even better brother, Tima says.
Then he smiles. So does Ramona. Peter clears his throat.
It's a terrible loss.
Tima turns his coffee cup, watching the small ripples on the surface.
You and your wife lost your first child, didn't you?
Peter takes a deep breath and closes his eyes.
Yes. Isak.
Do you ever get over it?
No.
Tima turns his cup around, around.
So how the hell do you go on living? He asks.
You fight harder,
Peter whispers.
Tima raises his cup in another toast. Peter hesitates for a while before finally saying,
I know you and your guys have always seen me as an enemy of the pack.
Maybe you were right too. I don't believe violence has any place around sports. But I'd like you to know that I understand that not everything in life is uncomplicated. I know it's your club too. I'm sorry about the times when I went too far.
Tima's fingernails click sadly against the porcelain cup.
Politics and hockey, Peter.
They should never come anywhere near each other. Peter takes a deep breath through his nose. I don't know if it's any use to you, but Richard Tiu tricked me.